All right, welcome to Computer Science 50, walkthrough 6. Today we're going to go over the sixth problem set, misspellings. Okay, so let's take a look at what this problem set is going to entail. So problem set 6, misspellings. This one, the topics are similar to what we did last time, data structures and pointers and more file I.O. But this time we're going to deal with more complex data structures, namely hash tables, tries, and other sorts of arrays and structs that you didn't come up with in the previous problem set. And you'll implement a dictionary for a very fast spell checker that will essentially look through a document and figure out all the mistakes in the document. So it's very similar to a Microsoft Word kind of spell checker. It just goes through your text document and allows you to highlight if you highlight all the mistakes in the document. Okay, so how do we go about doing this? Well, we go about doing this with using data structures and pointers and file.io. So we've got some distribution code again. So David goes over what a symlink is for two pages in the PDF, and I'll leave it up to you to read that at your own leisure. But I'm just going to show you how to copy this because it's a bit different from what we've been used to over the past few problem sets. Okay, so we're in our home directory. I'm logged in as Jane Harvard, and I'm going to copy the distribution code from the CS50's home directory. So instead of using cp-r, which was simply cp-recursive, which copied all the directories and files from the source, this time we're going to use -a, which is short for a bunch of different command line arguments, which I can't remember, but which are listed in the PDF, and that includes -r. So essentially, what we're doing is we're recursively copying the contents of the distribution code from CS50's home directory, but we're also copying symlinks, which are symbolic links and are very similar to Windows shortcuts from the home directory. Okay, so we're going to copy the contents of the distribution code from the from CS50's home directory using the cp-a command, cp-a CS50 pub distributions pset 6. Okay, and we should end up with a pset 6 directory. Okay, so what have we done with this symlink business? So as I was saying, symlinks are essentially shortcuts in Windows parlance. And what they do is point to a different path in the file system. So what we're doing here, we have this symlink called texts. Here it's highlighted in cyan. And it's pointing to home CS50 pub share pset 6 texts. So what it's doing is that it's basically acting as a shortcut, a link to the destination. And what is for all intents and purposes, it does the same thing as having a directory called texts in there with all the files that are inside texts. Okay, so we'll see what's inside this directory called texts. So you can see here that although it's a shortcut, we can just simply cd into it as if it were a regular directory. And then we see here that we have a bunch of files from prince.txt to wonderland.txt. And these are all the documents that have misspellings in them. And you're going to go through each of them with your program looking for all the mistakes in those files. So let's take a look at one of them. Which one do you want to take a look at? Choose anyone. Elf? Ralph? Okay, Ralph. Okay, this one's pretty short. When I grow up, I want to be a principal or a caterpillar. I love our principal Skinner. Okay, so here we have one of the shorter documents in here. It's not as long as, say, War and Peace, which is also one of the documents in the directory that you're going to test your code against. So here, what are the possible spelling errors in this document? Pardon? Wiggum? Yes, indeed. Wiggum is probably not in our dictionary. And that might be about it. Skinner? Yeah, possibly. But so one thing about our dictionary is that it's all lowercase. So it doesn't really care if a word is lowercase or uppercase in our document. So a skinner is it's a, like a regular occupation, so it might be in the dictionary. So so I guess there are like maybe one, maybe two misspellings in this document. Okay, so that's that. So note that the other documents will contain many more spelling errors, maybe on the order of hundreds or thousands, because these are really long documents, as you can see from the file sizes listed in LS. Okay, so now we've got the text files. So let's go back to our... Okay, so we've got the text files. We found that text was a symlink, but it acted as any other directory. The reason why it's a symlink and not a directory or and its text files inside is because we wanted to save space on the cloud, and we didn't want to copy War and Peace to everybody's home directory, because that would have been a little disastrous. Okay, and then we've got speller.c, which is our spell checker. Basically, speller.c will generate speller, which will be the binary that executes our spell checker and output all the results. And then we have dictionary.h, which is the header file for dictionary.c, which is a dictionary implementation. You'll be doing all your coding in dictionary.c and dictionary.h. You should not be modifying speller.c because it simply provides a framework for benchmarking and for actually running your code. And makefile, our old friend. We all know what a makefile is now, right? Okay. And then questions.txt, that thing. That you still have to answer some questions for this problem set, but please see the PDF for details. Okay, so we'll take a look at each of the files. Speller.c is in the distribution code. Is this speller.c? Is it? I can't see very well. Okay, thanks. So this is speller.c. And basically what it's doing is it's opening a text file, for example, ralph.txt or wonderland.txt or any of the other text files that were in texts. And it's also opening another file called words home in CS50's home directory. And this is the dictionary that contains all the words that we count as valid in when we're running speller. So we'll take a look at dictionary to see what it actually is. Okay. So this is what words is. It basically consists of the of a very large list of English words in the dictionary. So what are some things that we can note in this last screen of words? What are some characteristics of this dictionary that, say, you might not find in your regular paper dictionary? Mm-hmm.
It includes apostrophes.
Right, it includes apostrophes. Yes, that's very good. So if there's a possessive noun, for example, then it's going to contain those variants as well. That's going to be very important later on. What else? So one thing I mentioned was that everything is in lowercase. Even, for example, Zurich is in lowercase, although it should be in uppercase in a regular dictionary. And what else? I guess that's about it. Is there anything else that's special about this dictionary? Okay, so all these characteristics of the dictionary are also listed in the PDF. And you should really take a close look at page 8 of the PDF, which contains the specifications of the dictionary. Because you do have to realize that it's not only this dictionary that your speller might encounter, but also other dictionaries in a similar kind of format. So do take a look at the specifications very closely and bear them in mind when you're programming your speller. Okay, so this is speller.c, and I haven't really shown you the code yet. Okay, so what do we have here? We have int main, which is our main function. And it looks like we're getting some arguments, speller and the dictionary, which is optional, and then the file that we're checking checking for misspellings. And then we have a bunch of code here, R usage, before, after, and all this number stuff. This is just for benchmarking purposes. So if you run when you run your spell checker, for example, if we run the the solution code pset 6 speller, for example, let's see if we can run on Ralph. So we'll run the solution code on ralph.txt. And as you can see, it's identified the one misspelled word, which was Wiggum. Very good. And it says one word misspelled. And it's got a bunch of times here in seconds that just show how long each of the processes in the speller program took. So what the code in speller.c is doing here is basically implementing that benchmarking process. So you really don't need to worry about this because it's been taken care of in speller.c, and it's got nothing to do with what your code is doing. It's basically just it's like a stopwatch. You don't need to worry about it. So that's the code for the benchmarking. And then here, there's some important code here. So we've determined the dictionary to read from. It's either coming from the command line, or we're using the default dictionary. And then what are we doing here? We're calling a function called load, which presumably just loads the dictionary into memory. Then we're opening the file that we're checking misspellings for. And then we're running your code using, let's see. Yes. So we're calling the check function of your speller. This is implemented in dictionary.c. And basically, what your code is going to do is say whether this word, so if I give you a word, say Wiggum, is this misspelled or not? And if it is, you'll say false. And if it isn't, you'll say true. So that's what check is doing. And if we go down, we have some similar code dealing with file IO in the speller. And here you can see how we're printing out each of the benchmark results. So this is speller.c, and I've just gone through the code very briefly. And basically, what you should take away from this is that it's just running your code. It's not doing anything that you should modify. Just concentrate on dictionary.c when you're implementing your spell checker. Okay. So do you have any questions about speller.c? Great. Okay. So we'll go on to the next file. Which is dictionary.h. So you can tell a lot about a C file, a C source code file, from its accompanying .h file. Because if you've looked at any of the previous .h files that we've handled, they often declare all the functions before you actually implement them in the C source code file. Okay, so it's like a manifesto. You're just writing out all the functions that you're going to implement, and all the structs that you're going to use, and constants, and anything else that you might use in your C file should go in your .h file so that we can see a high-level description of what your code is going to do. Okay, so let's see. If we open dictionary.h, is this dictionary.h? Okay, so this is dictionary.h. It's pretty simple. So here we're defining the check function that I talked about. Returns true if word is in the dictionary, else false. It takes a constant char star word and returns a boolean, true or false. Then we have the load function. It loads the dictionary into memory. Returns true if successful, else false. And it takes a dictionary file name as its sole parameter. We also have size, which is a function that returns the size of a dictionary in an unsigned int, and then unload, which unloads the dictionary from memory. So actually, these are the functions that you're going to implement in this problem set: check, load, size, and unload. So these four functions are basically what you're going to implement using in problem set 6. So let's see if we can get our cursor back. Okay, so that was the distribution code. So as I said, what to implement. We're going to load a dictionary into memory, probably. And then size gets the size of the dictionary, unloads the dictionary, and checks if the word is in the dictionary. Okay, so we'll see what this actually means. So let's see. Oops. Okay. So how are we going to go about implementing our dictionary? Oops. Sorry, I'm having a little computer trouble here. Okay, so how can we implement a dictionary for our spell checker to use? Any ideas? So remember, we have a very huge dictionary called Words or something else, and we have a text file that we're supposed to check misspellings for. So how can we go about going through each word in the text file and checking to see if they're correct or not? Mm-hmm. Yes, linked list. We could certainly use linked lists, and it'll be part of our hash table implementation later. Any other ideas? There are so many ways to do this. Yeah? A tree? A try? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay, so what I wrote at the top is the very slow but simple approach, which is linear search every time. So we get we're told a word, say Wiggum, and then we go through the dictionary looking for Wiggum, and if we find it, we say it's not a misspelling, and if we don't find it, we say it's a misspelling. But that's really slow, right? Because we all know that linear search is O of N, yes. O of N, so it's going to be very slow. Because if we have a, let's say you've just written your epic essay that's 20 pages long, and we have to go through each word in that document to look for and go through the dictionary each time that we look for those words, then we're going to end up waiting a very long time for our dictionary to end. And if you've seen the big board on the CS50.net website, you'll see that many of the implementations are going to be done in 7 seconds, 3 seconds, or even less. So we have to make sure that we optimize our code. And so we have to think in real-world terms. So we all know that O of 2n is effectively equal to O of n when we're talking about asymptotic notation. But in the real world, O of 2n is actually 2 times as slow as O of n. So when we implement our dictionary, we need to think about what we're actually doing. You know, if there's any code that we should scrap, then we should scrap it if it's not doing anything useful. Okay, so there's linear search, which we're not going to do. If you do implement linear search, I don't know how that's going to be graded, so don't blame me for that. There's hash tables, which was mentioned, which uses linked lists. And there's tries. Is everyone familiar with tries? No? Right. I wasn't familiar with it either when I was taking the course. And there's also other ways to do it. If you might not even need a data structure. If you Google for, say, spell checker algorithms, I mean, if you don't look at the actual code, you can research other ways to do it. But today we're going to look over hash tables and tries. So these are going to be our two main implementations today. Okay, so right, I said linear search was a bad idea because it goes through the dictionary file every time. And we all know that the disk is much slower than memory. Okay. Does everyone know that? Yeah? Okay. So if we have to go to the disk every time, then it's going to take a long time. But if we cache our dictionary in memory in some representation, then we're going to end up with much faster performance. So that's what hash tables and tries are going to do. Basically, what they're doing is that they're just two ways of doing the same thing. They're representing the dictionary in memory, in a try, you know, this kind of tree form, or in a hash table with linked lists. We'll see that later on. So remember that it's just basically putting the dictionary into memory. If there's any way we can put a dictionary into memory, then that's a valid way to approach this problem set. Okay. So first we'll take a look at hash tables. All right. So a hash table. what is a hash table? So as I said, all of these implementations are basically representations of our dictionary in memory. Okay, and this is one way to do it. So in this example, taken from Wikipedia, John Smith, Lisa Smith, Sam Doe, and Sandra D are four entries in a dictionary, or a directory in this case. Okay. And you see here we have keys, which are the original data points, and indexes, which is our hash table. And then we have key value pairs, which contain each of the individual entries. Now, what does this all mean? Basically, what it's doing is that it's assigning each of these keys, for example, John Smith, a number, say 873, and then when we ask our hash table, so let's say our hash table is like represented like this in memory already. Let's say we've done all the loading, so we're in our check function. We're going to ask the function, is John Smith in our dictionary? And it's going to go to John Smith, and with some magic, it's going to know that John Smith is 873. It's just basically let's say you just give everyone a number. So John Smith is 873, and then we go to 873, and we ask 873 what's in 873. So we go to, 873 will lead us to the entry that actually contains John Smith, and then if we find the entry in this list, then we know that it was found in the dictionary. That doesn't make sense, right? I mean, it's too abstract right now. So let's see. So we'll take this bit by bit. So the first process is going from key to index. Okay. So we're assigning each of the keys a number. And in this case, we can see that John Smith was assigned the number 873. Lisa Smith was assigned the number 1. Sam Doe was assigned 998. And Sandra D was also assigned the number 873. Okay. And then for each of these numbers, for example, let's take a look at index 1. Index 1 is a list containing one item, Lisa Smith. That's because of all the four items that we had in our original dictionary, only Lisa Smith mapped to 1. Does that make sense? Yeah. Please raise your hand if it didn't make sense. Okay. So we'll take a look at another example. Sam Doe pointed to 998. So we look at the list called 998, and we see that Sam Doe was the only item in the list. Okay, so that's because only Sam Doe mapped to 998. But we have a special case at 873 because both John Smith and Sandra D mapped to 873. So now what we have is a list, a linked list, that contains John Smith and Sandra D. Does that make sense? Yeah. So do you see what this algorithm is doing and why it might be better than simply linear searching? Why is it better?
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. So you only need to do linear search when we've gone to a specific record chain. For example, we don't need to linear search for John Smith in the whole list of names. We only need to search inside the list containing John Smith and Sandra D. Right? So do you see how it's faster than just plain linear search? It's because we've whittled down the entire list into a shorter list, as you said, once we've reached the linked list. Okay. And so we have to come up with some way to convert keys, which are strings, into these numbers, for example, 873. And we also have to find out a way of representing this linked list in memory. So, first of all, how do we want to convert from a key to index? What was this called? Converting from some string or number to another kind of index? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's called hashing. So we need something called a hash function to do this dirty work for us. So it'll convert John Smith to 873, Sandra D to 873, for example. So this is going to be our hash function. And so we'll take a look at an example of a hash function. Let's see. OK, so what was a very simple hash function that we could use when representing strings in a hash table? So this is from lecture. Pardon? Taking the mod, yeah. So we can come up with the first letter of the person's name and then take the mod of that, the mod of the size of the array. And then, someone whose name begins with A will end up with the entry 0. And someone whose name begins with a Z will end up with hash entry 26. Okay. So I've written here a pseudocode for another hash function. So this one is a little bit more complex than simply taking the first letter of someone's name. So can you see from the hash function what it might do? Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So it adds up all the ASCII values of each character in the string and then mods that by array size. So what is array size in this case? String length? Right, yeah. So array size is the size of our hash table. If we go back to the diagram, array size is the size of the table that contains all the indexes. So in this case, it would be 1,000, right? Because the indexes go from 0 to 999. So that's 1,000 entries. So array size in this case is 1,000. So does everyone see that this adds up all the ASCII values of each character in the string? Right? So we're going through each of the characters in the string. For each character in the string, hash result plus equals the character minus 65. And 65 is just A, the capital letter A, because we want to make sure that we want to start from 0 and go to 26 instead of a higher range. Okay? And then we're going to hash, so we're going to take our hash result, and then we're going to mod it by array size. So what is this modding doing? Why is it necessary at all? Yeah. So if we didn't, it's because we want to place all the entries in the hash table. If we didn't have this, then we might end up with entries that fall off the hash table because they're at the 1,020th entry, for example. So we want to mod that back to 20. Okay. So what might be a case when we might need to mod? So we don't need to mod in all cases, but we might need to mod when. Yeah, it's when it's bigger than array size. So, for example, if we had a very long name, for example, then we might have to mod that. If we have a bunch of Z's, then we might have to mod that pretty quickly because it's gonna the numbers, the ASCII values are going to add up. Okay. So, does everyone see what this hash function is doing? This is a very simple hash function, but it works, and it might be a little slow, but there are undoubtedly better hash functions out there. But it's a nice way to start hashing. Okay, so that's our hash function there. Okay, so now that we've got that hash function, we can convert from string from names that are strings to these indices, and then each of these indices are going to point to these key value pairs. So in this case, we've actually got more data than necessary because we've got the phone numbers of these people. But in our dictionary implementation, what items are we going to need in this key value pair in these records? So where do we actually use this hash table? I mean, what is our spell checker doing? It's
puts everything in the dictionary in the hash table so you can recall it when you're comparing words in the hash
Right, yeah, exactly. So a hash table is going to contain all the words in our dictionary. So we're going to use it when we want to look up a word, when we want to see whether a word is in the dictionary or not. Okay. So what are our records going to contain? If it's just if we're just looking to see if they exist or not, then our records can just contain the word itself. Yeah. So we don't need the phone number in this case. But we still need, notice that this green table row in HTML from today's lecture, you can see that there are three entries. One appears to be a pointer because there's an arrow pointing out of it, so it's probably a pointer. The second entry is the name, and the third entry is the phone number, which we can forget about for now. So we have a pointer in the first entry and a name. So does this appear to be something that a linked list might contain? Yeah? Right? So what might our linked list be defined as? So let me rephrase that. So a linked list consists of a series of nodes, right? And they're connected to each other via pointers. And what are each of those nodes, usually? Structs, yeah. So you can think of each of these records as structs. And in the next slide, what I've done is implement an example of a node in a hash table. So what do we have here? Type def struct node, char word 46. Why 46? Yeah, so 45 is the length of the longest word in the dictionary, which I'm not going to try and pronounce here. And 46, the 46th letter, or rather the last letter of 46 characters, is going to be the null terminator. Because if we don't have the null terminator, we might end up falling off the memory. Okay, so remember that a string in C is always ended with the null terminator. So we have char word 46. And that's going to safely contain all the words in our dictionary. It's probably going to waste some space because we're going to have much shorter words than 45 characters long. But that works. And then we have struct node next. And it's a node pointer to next. Can anyone tell me what next is going to be? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so next is going to point to the next node in our linked list. So think of these as, so if we have a linked list here, so you've probably seen these diagrams before, and you'll probably see them more in section, or you might have seen them, but this is our linked list, and basically what this is, it's a struct that, so we can think of this as our node here. And then this is the first element, which is word. So this is going to contain our word. And so these are all the same. These are all nodes. So they also contain words. And what is this going to point to? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is going to point to the next one. So this is next. It's a pointer to node. Sorry. Node star. Okay? And similarly, this one is going to point to the last one. And what about the last one? Where do we want to point that? What's a good place to point the last node in a singly linked list? Yep. Back to the first one? Yep, we could do that. But what might that induce? An infinite loop, yeah. So if we point it to the front one and we start looking for example, if we were looking for, say, Barack Obama in this list, and it didn't contain that list, the item in this list, if it didn't contain that name in this list, then it would continue looping around looking for it, but it would never find it, right? So, where else can we point this to? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we can point this to null. I represent this as this kind of character. This is null. So this isn't as hard as it seems. We're just going to define this as zero or null. Okay? So when we reach null, so when we're iterating through our list looking for names, and next is null, then where have we got ourselves? To the end, yeah. So when next is null, then we know that we've gone to the end of the list. Okay, so this is a our singly linked list, a linked list of each of the names. So if we go back to our diagram, then these represent the green records in the hash table. Okay, so how are we going to implement our actual hash table, our indices in C? What does it appear to be? Pardon? Yeah. Each of the indices is a number. And what about the pink places in the indices? Yeah, they're pointers. Okay. So basically, this looks. What does it look like? What kind of data structure does this look like? An array. Yeah, that's good. So we have. Maybe I should write it elsewhere. I wish I could reach there. So we have an array. Chris, can you see this? Okay, so we have an array here, and this is a regular array. It's indexed by number. So if the zeroth element in our array is going to be a pointer to somewhere. The first element is going to point to somewhere, and so on. So we can think of, for example, let's say that this green list, this linked list, represents all the names that hash to 3. So in that case, our pointer here would point to here, the beginning of this first node in the linked list. Yeah? So there are also going to be other linked lists here that are going to be similarly formatted. And this one goes to null. And for example, this might be the linked list that contains all the names that hash to 5. Yeah? Does everyone get this? This is crucially important. Yeah? OK, good. So this is our hash table. And we had our struct. And one more thing is the array that we just said existed, node star. See, we have a. Okay, so we have an array of nodes, right? So, So what is this? What is this array? What kind of type is it? Yeah, it's an array of pointers to the linked list, specifically nodes. Yeah. So this is an array of node pointers, right? So what I've done here is node star. It's a node pointer, and it's an array of array size. Okay. So that's our main directory of nodes, and that's where we're going to start searching every time we have a word to search for. All right, so now we've got this. What can we set array size to? What do you think might be a good value? Any guesses? Yeah, I mean 26 wouldn't be too bad. Of course, we don't know. It really depends on your hash function. If your hash function is going to end up with if it's going to end up with a lot of values dispersed around, then we might want to accommodate for that and create a large array size. Basically, it's up to you. I really didn't have an answer in mind when I asked that question. So array size can be anything you want, depending on your hash function, and maybe depending on experimentation, depending on how much RAM you want to use. It's really a compromise between performance and memory usage, right? Because the bigger... Yes? Okay, so let's say we have so the question was, how is it a compromise between speed and memory usage, and which ones contribute to which? So if we have a huge array size, let's say array size 65,000, then what are we going to use up? What resource are we using? RAM, memory, yeah. So so we have a huge hash table, and then we have maybe just a few linked lists dangling off it. Is it going to be fast? Is it going to be slow? Pardon? Fast, yeah. That's exactly right. But why? Why is it going to be fast? Mm-hmm. Yeah, correct. So if we have a huge array size, then once we reach one of those linked lists, then we're going to have a very easy job of searching for the names. Do you see why? Because each of the names are dispersed throughout the list so much that each of the linked lists is probably going to be like one or two members long. Okay. So if we have a very short array size, then what are we going to end up with? What resource are we going to use? What resource are we not going to use? RAM, yeah. So we're going to use a very small piece of RAM to represent the hash table itself. But we're going to lose out on speed, right? Because, for example, if with a big array size, we might end up with two names per linked list. But if we have a very small array size, then we're going to have to mod. So we'll end up with a lot of names linked off each linked list. So we're going to do a lot of linear searching through those lists. So do you see how this is a compromise between speed and resource usage? Okay. So yeah, that's a very big consideration, and I'm glad you brought that question up when you try to decide your array size. Okay? So any questions so far? No? Is everyone confident that they can implement this now? Yeah? Okay. Let's see. Okay, so we'll take a quick tape break here, and we'll talk about implementing tries instead of hash tables. Okay, so we're going to talk about how we're going to actually do these operations with the data structures that we've talked about so far. Okay, so how do we initialize our hash table? So remember that our hash table was an array, and it contained pointers to each of the linked lists. Now, at the beginning of our program, when there aren't any words in the dictionary, what is our hash table going to look like? Yep, it's still going to be an array because, remember, we defined it as node star my array size. So it's still going to be an array, but what is the array going to contain? Mm-hmm, yeah, so it's not going to contain anything at the beginning because, obviously, we don't have any words. And if we don't have any words, we don't have any of these linked lists. Okay, so how can we represent the fact that our linked list is empty, that there is actually no linked list leading from, say, hash value 4. So what seems to be the theme here? We had this null thing here, which represented that it was the end. Can't we just call this the end of the linked list? Yeah? So to represent the fact that there are no words currently that map to the hash value 4, then we could just point this to null. Or rather, point this to null is rather ambiguous. So this will be null. Okay. So my array square brackets 4 equals null is how we would initialize our array. Okay. So our array is going to contain null pointers at first. It's going to be a huge list of null pointers that are not going to point anywhere, signifying the fact that there are no words currently that maps to that hash function. Does everyone get that? A hash value, sorry. Okay. So that's our initialization. It's not very complicated at all because it's just a table of pointers. But how do we add words? How do we add words to our hash table? Let's say this is the first word that we're adding to our hash table. It might be the letter A. Any ideas? Yeah, so we have to figure out what hash value it's going to compute to. And also, we're going to have to find a place for it in memory and point and somehow figure out a way to point to that portion of memory that represents the word that we're adding. Okay. So in less abstract terms, what's that going to do? So we talked about structs, and we talked about how each of these nodes was a struct. And let's say we're adding a new word. So so we have here our struct, and this is our word, and this is our pointer to next. So how, first of all, how are we going to define a new struct? How are we going to construct a new struct? Any ideas? So first of all, are we going to put it on the heap or on the stack? The heap, yeah. So we're going to put it on the heap because... Pardon? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're going to use malloc. That's because if we put it on the stack, then once our add word function ends, we're going to lose that portion of memory. So the thing is, we only initialize once to load all the words into memory. And then we're going to call chunk, check a bunch of times. And then we're going to unload the dictionary. Do you see how it is? So here's this huge heap of memory. And we're going to load things into it with the load function. And then we're going to call this tiny function check, which will look at that heap several times during the program's execution. And then at the end of the program, this whole heap will be unloaded from memory. OK? So so we have our struct here called node. How are we going? So we talked about how we were going to malloc it. So how can we do that? How do we malloc some space for this struct that we have here? Yeah, so we can just do malloc size of node, and that's going to create our new node in memory. Oh, so and one thing, node, remember our typedef struct implementation that we had in the previous slides? Node should be in dictionary.h. That's just a convention that we put all our structs in an h file instead of in the .c file. I mean, it'll still work, but it's cleaner that way. Okay, so malloc size of node. Malloc is going to return a pointer. So what is this a pointer to? We're defining this, which is a node. So this is going to be a node pointer. Let's call it n for now. Node pointer n equals malloc size of node. So now we've created a new node in our linked list, which doesn't exist yet, and we've assigned it to this pointer n. Okay. So first, how can we initialize the contents of this struct? What's the first thing that we have to initialize here? The word, right? So how can we? So this is our add function, and our add function is going to get a string. So how we Let's say the string is called word. How are we going to add this word? How are we going to record this word as the word of this struct? Anyone have any ideas? So we're dealing with n, right? Because this is going to point to our this is pointing to our node right now. And then what?
Arrow.
Arrow. Yeah, so in our implementation, it was word. So we'll call it word equals word. Well, okay, this might have been a little confusing. This was the name of the element supplied in the typedef struct definition. And this word is in our current instance. Maybe we should call it my word or something like that. Okay, so that's very simple. We've allocated some memory for this struct of ours, and we've put the word into it. And okay, so where are we going to put this struct in this linked list? So I said there were no words right now. So what are we going to do? Where can we put this struct, this node? Oh, maybe I should have mentioned that my word maps to the value too. So we can find that out, right? For example, int hash value equals. So if our hash function is called my hash function, okay. So hash value contains the value 2 right now because my word maps to 2. So how are we going to put this struct in the place where it belongs? At the moment, it's just floating around in memory, and we have a pointer to it. But once our function dies or leaves, it's going to end up with there's going to be nothing referencing it. So we have to put it in its rightful position, which is where? Mm-hmm. Pardon? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we would want to put it in. Did you say n? Okay. So we need to put it in one of these in a position of this table, right? So let's call this my array. So my array square brackets hash value equals what? So basically, what are we doing? We have our this at the moment is null, but what should this be at the end of our function? Pardon? N, yeah. So it should be the value of n, because it's going to be a pointer to our struct, right? Does everyone get that? Cool. Okay, so what can we do? My array hash value equals n. Okay, so now we could do this right now because we know that the dictionary is empty. But what if the dictionary isn't empty? Can we just do this? Can we use the same code? What would happen if there was an existing word in the two linked list? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would override the pointer that leads to the existing words. So what do we do in that case? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have to find the end of the current linked list, and then assign and then tack that new struct onto the end of that existing linked list. Okay. So how can we do this? How can we go through each of the items in the linked list? I'm sorry. Can you speak up?
We go out to the end of the linked list, which is the null pointer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we go through each of the items in the linked list, presumably with a while loop or something. And then when we reach the end of the list, we're going to change that value next, which is currently pointing to null, to n. Okay, does everyone see that? How we're tacking on that new struct, that new node, to the end of the existing linked list. Okay, so what's a clever way to implement this? Bearing in mind that the end of the linked list and a blank blank item in this table is also null. What is a clever way? Instead of asking ourselves, does our linked list exist right now, or is there a linked list and are we at the end? Those two can actually be conflated into one. Mm-hmm. In both cases, the pointer will be null. And in both cases, we want to change that null value to n, right? So it seems like we can come up with a nice for loop or a nice while loop that looks for null. So while node next, or well, node next wouldn't work. So, well, I'll wave my hands at that for now. But that's part of the implementation, right? It's not that hard to figure out. Basically, you might have a temporary value that points to the current node that we're working with. And it'll start off pointing to, it'll start off pointing to this location, and then it'll point to this and point to the next node and the next node and the next node and so forth. And when that value becomes null, we know that we've reached either the end of the linked list or a blank value here, so we can simply change that value. Does that make sense? Tell me if it doesn't. Okay, so that's how we add our new node. Am I missing anything? No? Okay, so that's adding words. How do we check for words? How do we see if a word currently exists in our hash table and its linked lists? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we first find the hash value of the word that we're checking, and then we go to that location in the hash table, and then we find out if that word is there using a linear search, as we mentioned before. Okay? So let's say we've added our word here, and it's A. So let me erase this null because it's no longer null. So we have the word A, and it hashes to the value 2 according to our hash function, myHashFunc. And it's 2, so we go here. So let's say that the word didn't exist in the dictionary, so this was null. Now we know that the word doesn't exist, right? If the very first thing that we read, the hash table, says that there are no words that hash to 2, then we know that the word probably doesn't exist, right? But if it does point somewhere, then we can go to that location, and then what do we do there? We've reached a node, and we want to find out, this is a linear search, so we just want to find out if this is the word that we're looking for. Okay? So we see if, let's say our temporary node pointer is n here again. So we see n word, if n word equals the word we're looking for, then we found it, so finish our search. If not, then continue our search. So go to the next pointer. Okay? Does everyone see what I'm getting at? Yeah. How the check function will work? Does anyone have any questions?
I'm not clear on how to move from one to the next.
Okay. Yeah. So So the question was, how do we go from each node to the next? So okay, I'm gonna erase this. So okay. So let's say we have a node pointer, n. This is just a temporary value that that stores the current node, stores a pointer to the current node in memory. So how do we go on to the next node? In very simple terms, we've done all the checks. How do we go on to the next node? Or rather, what is the address of the next node? How do we find that out? We've got n, which is the current node.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So in our implementation, it was called next. So n next. So this is the address of our next node that we want to go to. So how can we move to that next node? Move. Yes. So you don't malloc anything new, because what we're doing is we're simply going on to the next node. So this is us. This code is used when we're adding words and when we're checking for words, because we're going through each word. What do we do? It's much simpler than malloc. So recall that this was just our temporary value, so we can change it however we want, and we have some sort of loop here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just put n equals n next. And this is the end of our current iteration. So now that's going to move our pointer to the next one. It's just like moving a finger to the next one. Okay. So, of course, before we go to n next, we have to figure out if n is null. Because if n is null, then we're going to be screwed if we go n next, because there's nothing that n points to. So this might be a while loop that says while n not equals null. Now, I'm not saying this implementation works, but it's the general idea. While n is not null, then n next. Does this seem to work? Any objections to this? I mean, I hope it works. So let's say we were printing out each of the names in our linked list, which we might implement as a debug function, right? We might say printf percent s word, oops, n word. So let's say here we initialize n to some pointer value that we know to be the start of a linked list, and then we print out each of the names in the linked list. Does everyone see how this code works and that it does indeed work? Or it might not, but that it looks like it works? Yeah? Okay, so if you've got that, then that's great. You've mastered linked lists, because basically what you're doing when you're going through a linked list is that you're doing a linear search. So you're going through each of the items, checking to see if the word that you're looking for is there. So when does this while loop terminate? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when it's reached the end of the list, it'll terminate. Also, if n was supplied, for example, if n was pointing to this entry in the array, it'll terminate immediately. And so you'll also know that there's no linked list there. Okay. So that's the general idea for going through a linked list. And you'll actually use that for adding, checking, and unloading. Now, do you have any questions about any of the stuff that we covered so far? No? Okay. So unloading words. What is unloading words? We talked about the huge heap, and we talked about when the program ends. So if we load anything from memory, and we malloc things, then we have to destroy them, right? We have to free any memory that we malloc. Yeah? So basically what unloading words is going to do is to destroy everything that we've just created and then return that memory to the operating system. Okay. So how are you going to go about doing this? Any ideas? Yeah, we're just going to free the space that we've allocated. So what space have we allocated so far? So the array, have we really allocated the array? Did we call malloc on the array? No. Right, yeah. So the array we defined in the stack, because we said node star my array size. So that was basically just in the stack, or in the, it might be a global variable. Does everyone know what a global variable is? Okay, so it's just a global variable, so it's going to live in the stack and not in the heap. So what we malloced was linked lists, right? Each of the linked lists leading from each of the hash values was malloced. Each of the structs was malloced, actually. So what do we have to do about freeing this? How can we free each of the structs, the nodes that we malloced before? Yeah? Mm-hmm. So we can go backwards and free each of the nodes. But there's a slight problem here. We're dealing with singly linked lists. And what is the property of singly linked lists? You can't go back, right? So with a doubly linked list, you can go back and forwards as well, because it has a pointer to the previous node. But with a singly linked list, we can only go forwards. So how are we going to destroy the entire linked list, destroy each of the nodes of the linked list, without going into the catch-22 situation of, oh, I've already destroyed the node, so I don't know where the next pointer is? Do you see how that is? Because if we've destroyed the struct, we have no more information about what the next struct.
You can, like, temporarily store it, mm-hmm. and destroy it, and then that you temporarily remembered it, so you know what.
Right. Yeah. So we'll have a temporary variable of some sort that stores the next value of node, and once we've destroyed the current node, we'll just simply use that temporary variable to jump to the next item in the next node in the linked list. Okay. So you can see here that it's going to use the same kind of while loop business, going through each of the nodes in the linked list, and it's going to free them one by one. And then when it reaches null, when n next, or when the temporary value is null, then we know that we've reached the end of the linked list. So we don't need to bother about that linked list anymore. Do you see how you might implement this? Yeah? Does anyone have any questions? Any questions at all? No? OK, so we'll go into tries. The thing about tries is that it will be less code to write, but it will be more complex code to write. So this is another trade-off between whether you want simple but long code and not so simple but short code. OK, so does everyone remember what a try was from lecture? This was very briefly covered. And this was the diagram from the PowerPoint slide. So what do we have here? What can you tell me one word that's in this dictionary?
Turing,
yep. So T, we have our first array of letters, and that there's from the T entry, we can go to U, which goes to R, I, N, G, and then delta, which is the end of our current word. So what's another word that's in there? Sorry, what? Fossil?
The next one from the
right. Oh, Poisson, yeah. Poisson is also in the dictionary. So basically, even though it appears that there are only three letters at the top, we can see here that there are actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 words in this try. So can you see what a benefit of a try might be? Yeah, so it seems that a try is going to share some space between words. If the prefix of the word is very similar, for example, Mendel, as you said, Mendel and Mendeleev, those share the same common prefix, so they're going to be in the same portion of the try. So it seems that it could save space. But it also has this enormous overhead of having each of these characters as an array every time you create a new level in the try, because you do have to realize that even though, for example, the third letter of Mendel n seems to only contain one item in the array, it's still a long array that contains all the alphabetical characters, right? So that's in our case, it's actually not 26 because we have the apostrophe. So it's 27 characters in the array. So that's important to remember. So you can see here that every time we create a new level, we're creating 27. We're creating an array that contains 27 characters. Okay. So that's our try. And how can we implement this try? So once again, here we've created an example implementation of a try in and its nodes. So typedef struct node, bool is word, a boolean representing the fact whether we've reached the end of a word or not, and then a children array, which is an array of node pointers. Do you see how this relates to the diagram before? So when we had the delta characters, that was is word false. Sorry, is word. Okay, so yeah, is word is would be the delta character. So if is word is true, then we know that we've reached the end of the chain of letters in the word, and so we've reached the end of that chain. So is word would be true, and children is the array containing each of the arrays. Sorry, it's an array containing pointers to the next level in our try. So let's go back to the diagram. Okay, so let's see here. So we have Turing. So what's the first, what's U? U is a node, right? So what is it going to contain in, is it a word? Is U a word? Is word going to be true or false? False, yeah. So is word is going to be false because TU is not a word. Okay, so we know that we haven't reached the end of the word. And so U is just an element in an array containing A, B, C, D, F, G, up to Z, and apostrophe. And that's going to point, so the U item in the array is going to point to the next node, which contains the R. Do you get it? So the thing about these trinodes is that they don't contain the actual letter. They contain a whole bunch of letters in an array. And when one of these items in the array point to another place, we know that we can continue down that route. But if not, then it's we know that it's not a word. So let me show you how this looks in memory. So we have our node here. This is our first node, our root node. So let's say we're going to define the word Turing. So this starts with A and this starts with Z, so T is probably going to be somewhere around here. So where is T going to point to? This is a pointer, so any ideas? No? So, like a linked list, each of these elements in the tri are nodes, okay? And a node is a struct as we defined in the next slide. So, we're actually going to have another node here that points, maybe this diagram is a little, it's not representing everything that we have, because remember we have the is word Boolean. So let's say this is word, and this one too. So this is our node, okay? And A, Z, and then U. So this points to this node, and then U somewhere in U. So this U pointer points to R. Do you see what this tri is representing? Yeah? So it's a little bit more complex than our hash table because we have this long array, and it's difficult because each of the nodes don't represent a word. Okay? So the nodes don't represent words. They represent portions of words and how you can continue if you want to create a word. Okay, so T points to U. So T points to an array that has a pointer dangling from U. That points to an array that has a pointer dangling from R. Do you see how this works?
And so every time something points to an array, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the question was, do all the arrays that we have, are they all 27 characters long? And the answer is yes, they are. And yes, you can have null pointers that, for example, if we can't go from TU to Z, for example, then the Z element in the array that says U right there is going to be null. Okay? Are there any more questions? Okay, so this is how we're going to implement structs. And they are a bit more complex, as I said, than the hash table implementation. So let's talk about how we might actually use these tries. So how do we initialize our root node? So this is when we're initializing the dictionary, when we're going to start reading the words from the dictionary. How can we first create how can we create our first root node, the one that contained the one that acted as the parent of all the other nodes. So just because it's a try doesn't mean it's special. It's still a struct. So how do we initialize a struct? Malloc. Yeah. So if you go back to the hash table example, then we have the same thing here. Node star n equals malloc, and then size of node. Okay. All right. So how can we add words to our try? Any ideas? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we start off with the first letter of the word. So for example, if the word was Turing, then we'd start we'd find the first letter of the word, which is T in this case. And then what would we do? We have this root node here. How do we signify the fact that a word beginning with T exists? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we make the T element point to something. So at that point, we have to define a new struct if this relation T to U doesn't exist. If there's no existing struct that points from T, then we have to initialize it. So I see some confused faces. So this struct contains references to all the words that begin with T. Okay, so it's going to contain TA, TB, TC, TD. Do you see that? And similarly, will, for example, A contain AA, AB, AC, AD. This will be another struct. So how many structs are there in the second layer? If this is the first layer, then how many structs do we create in the second layer, assuming that we have all possible permutations of words? 26 or 27. That's true. we don't have words that start with an apostrophe. So, you don't need to worry about that special case because we're not going to add any words. So we can say that all of these nodes are equivalent. We can all call them node. So they all have a 27-character long array. Okay. So how do we go about adding a word to a try? We've gone to T, and then we've gone to U, and then we can probably repeat that process, right? Then what if we reached G in Turing, the end of the word? Mm-hmm, yeah. So instead of creating a new struct that dangles off it, you can specify. Sorry. So Turing. Okay. So let's say this is G. So T-U-R-I-N-G, and then the G pointer will point to. What? Pardon? Null? Not exactly. That could be a possible implementation, but we have isWord for a reason. So we're going to have another struct here, the one that was represented using a delta in the previous slide. So you see, the delta was actually taking up an array of its own. It was taking up 27 characters just to represent delta. So this is another one. But instead of there being pointers dangling off these arrays, remember this part was isWord. So isWord is going to be true. Yeah? Because isWord signifies the fact that it's the end of the word chain, the letter chain. Okay? All right, so that's adding words. I sort of wave my hands through the process, and you look confused, but... It's actually going to be pretty short in terms of lines of code. So think about it on paper or on the screen, and think about how you might implement that if you go for a try, that is. And then checking words is very similar. We go through each of the nodes, looking for each of our letters in our word, and then if we reach isWord, when we reach the end of say if we reach G and it says isWord. If G points to a struct that whose isWord element is true, then we know that the word exists. But if it doesn't, then we know that the word doesn't exist. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, and unloading words is going to be very similar again to the hash table implementation. But this time, instead of simply going through linked lists, we're going to have to say, so we start off here, and we try to unload everything. So so what's a good approach to doing this? Instead of an iterative approach, what was the other kind of approach? Recursive, yeah. So we can take a recursive approach. So we start off here, and then we actually ask this to free itself. Or rather, so we have a function, if we have a function unload, then we can start off unloading from here. And then if that isn't the end of a word, or rather if that array doesn't have any more children, then we're going to free it. If not, then we're going to ask each of the children to be freed. Do you see how that works? So basically what we're doing is we're starting at the top and then asking each of the smaller elements to be freed. And each of those ask the smaller element, its children, to be freed. And at the very end, when there are no more children, it just frees it, the struct itself. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So we'll quickly go on to some tips. So whichever implementation you go for, hash tables, tries, or anything else that you might find, start with a small dictionary. Don't go for the words file just yet, because it's a huge file, and you'll end up with more headaches than successes if you begin debugging with the large dictionary file. So just create a new dictionary of your own. You just need to open up Nano, just type in a few words, and put a new line between them, and then just save that. So remember that speller takes an optional element, dict, which contains our dictionary. So for example, if our new dictionary is called new dict, then speller new dict, and then our file will load speller with that dictionary. Okay. And similarly, you should start with a small text file as well. So don't start. You can start off with Ralph, but it might be simpler to start off with a text file that only contains, say, one word or two words. So if you start debugging, then start with those small text files, and then small text files and small dictionary, and then begin testing your code with bigger ones, and then finally the largest one. Okay, and then when you if you're thinking about these data structures and you're becoming confused, try to write them out on paper. I feel it helps me, and it might help you. You can also write some debug functions. For example, the code that I had here that printed out every word in the linked list for hash table could have been a very good debug function, because you could see what your linked list looked like, right? So when we're dealing with all these abstract data structures, so if we want to see a visual representation of it to be sure that it works, so we can create these temporary debug functions in your code, okay? So that's like printf, but it's a more robust version of printf. Okay, and then using GDB. Are you familiar with GDB, the GNU debugger? Sort of, yeah. It's an awesome tool, but it's also very it has lots of commands and lots of arcane syntax. But if you look at the resources page on the CS50.net website, we have a tutorial that's linked from there that helps you work through GDB. So that might help, because GDB is also useful in debugging seg faults, because it'll tell you where those segmentation faults are occurring. So if you run into those memory problems and data structure problems, then do take a look at GDB. Okay, so that's it for CS50 Walkthrough 6, and we'll see you next week with Problem Set 7. Thank you.